Welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. In the pantheon of legendary acting couples, one pair stands out for their talent, longevity, and civic contribution, Ozzie and Ruby. Celebrating their 50th anniversary this year, Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee are living legends of the American stage and screen. They're actors, writers, directors, producers, whose distinguished careers not only established them among the greats, but whose shared commitments to artistic activism and civil rights helped transform the social landscape of the late 20th century.
From their early days as struggling actors in Harlem's community theaters to their groundbreaking work on Broadway and in Hollywood, Ozzie and Ruby have profoundly reshaped the landscape for artists and audiences over the past five decades. Through the roles they played, the projects they created, and the lives they lead, they have established themselves not just as an enduring celebrity couple, but as pioneers in their art and in our culture.
Join Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg as they spend the next hour with Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee in this life together. I thought this was a very sexual book because there's a fluidity and a liquidity to it. There's very much of a cultural sensitivity in the format. Mm-hmm. Things kind of intersperse and interweave. There's a passage from Ozzie and a passage from Ruby and their lives together and their lives singly, and then they come back together. Yeah, uh-huh. And it's a very beautiful intertwining and meshing together. But maybe the first thing that you folks are real busy. I keep stumbling literally over you, telling you how wonderful you are at all kinds of activities. How in the world, given the fact that you are such productive people, your family people, why this book at this time? Why take the space and the time to put together with Ozzie and Ruby in this life together?
I had to twist Ozzie's arm for us to get it together, to get this book done, because we had had several invitations from several major publishers, and we never wanted to do it. Ozzie never wanted to do it. I thought about it, but I look upon him as the writer, you see, in the family. And he said he didn't want to. Why didn't want to tell the story?
Well, I like to tell stories spontaneously. A room full of grandchildren, and I'm off and running. And I can tell it, you know, automatically without having to stop and edit and correct things. But the minute you begin to write it, then the whole editorial process comes to bear. Did it really happen in 1952? Was it that way or was it this way? Then you got to go and do research and all of it. And my life is interesting, but not enough to be researched.
If I could
stand up and just tell the story of my life, right now, I do a marvelous job. But to write it, it gets boring and all that stuff.
Oh, I don't think it was boring.
I avoid it like the plague.
And he says sometimes he doesn't even believe it.
Well, let me chime in for just a second and ask a question also with regard to, you're talking about a number of different worlds that intersect, the worlds of the performing arts and the world of what you say a number of times is the struggle. Mm-hmm. How do you see those two worlds intersecting, and what got both of you involved in both of those struggles?
Oh, that's a long
question. Okay.
We'll give a short answer.
In terms of some specific thing, Ozzie came from the South. I came from the North. We came from struggle areas. You know, he comes from racism, and overt, blatant racism in the South. I come from another kind of racism in the North and in the city. So we come together with a familiarity with struggle. Mm-hmm. And from as far back as we can realize anything, our parents were involved. I remember walking picket lines with my mother, you know. It doesn't strike me as strange that Ozzie and I walk picket lines with our children. You know, it just seemed part of a total way of life that informed, that history helped to inform who we were, and in turn we passed some of that down to our children. And I don't see what people live about if they're not struggling for something.
When I consider the time we met, 1946, the world had just gone through a cataclysmic experience, mm-hmm. of which racism was one of the keys. Everybody was concerned to do something about racism. when the soldiers were coming back, black soldiers coming back from the army, instead of a hero's welcome, you know, they were getting killed or lynched, and so that the whole question of the whether the black folks had won World War II was very much being agitated, and we also came down to work in one of the first shows that Broadway had accepted after it sort of opened its arm to black people. So there we were with many currents going, but the one that was most persistent was what to do about certain things that were happening in the world. And every night after the performance, somebody would pass you a note that we're going to go down to the village because we're raising funds for William McGee, or somebody would have a fundraiser for some other thing, and we would go down, and there would be Paul Robeson on one side of the room, Orson Welles on the other, and Marlon Brando at the door or something. So we naturally came into a world that was exciting, that was new, where struggle was of great importance to us. I mean, when I first joined Access Equity, there was a clause in Access Equity that said I didn't have to work in a theater in Washington, D.C., because it segregated the audiences. Just belonging to the union, you know, was an act of struggle. So I was involved as a natural consequence of just being there, and so was Ruby. It was a wonderful time, and we in the theater and at that time took it upon ourselves to decide what kind of world was going to take place after World War II. You know, what to do about the atom bomb, or what to do about the promises against colonialism that had been made, and what to do about trying to get an anti-lynching bill through Congress. All of these things were thrown at us by the people with whom we associated, and by activities that were happening. And we belonged to the NAACP. We belonged to the Urban League. These were the places to be. So struggle, in that sense, was a natural part of the environment into which we stepped. And as Ruby said, we came from families where struggle was a main ingredient of the life. We were, at that time, an oppressed people in the sense that we are not now, although the changes, you know, some in some instances have been cosmetic. But a world of segregation, a world of Jim Crow, you know, even getting finding a hotel room to live in downtown New York, you know, was an impossibility. Mm-hmm. So there's always something to struggle about.
Yeah. We haven't written a politically, I don't call myself that politically, a scientist, a political scientist, or anything like that. As we've tried to write a book, I think that describes how something about how the affairs of life as black people in America affected us in very personal ways, you know, and it's like, so that's how that comes about. I couldn't go into many reasons and deep political or sociological reasoning. I only wrote it as it struck us in those very personal and direct ways. Ossie did too, I think, maybe to a little, maybe a little further along, and about the in and outness of the way we wrote. It was something that we have to thank Sydney Mahone for that. She helped us with the organization, the structure that gave it what you might call that sensuous quality. I like to think of that because I think of this struggles of all people. As kind of a sensuous experience, we don't know it, but this is what we're about, you know, this back and forth and in and out and trying to make the wheels mesh and make sense out of our times and the things that happen to us. I appreciated that description.
You're not going to suggest the struggle is an aphrodisiac, are you?
Well, in
and
a sense,
struggle,
it is.
Good, you don't need Viagra. Is that
there is one part of the book that we haven't talked about in which we distinctly describe the fact that when you come across people who are caring, who are sacrificing, who are loving and passionate, there is a sensuality about them. You know, there's a sensuality in observing people who care and who struggle and who go through things to make something better, their lives, other people's lives, somebody, just some one person's life. So I've found that to be a very sensuous element in terms of personal relationships. I won't even call it allegiance, this capacity, it's almost like you can't help yourself, this struggle. You have to struggle to move from one point to another. And life is based, and all life comes from these oppositions. Even in terms of marriage itself, it's a struggle, you know. And those tenets, they interrelate. The political struggles, the family struggles, the government, and walking is a struggle, and deals with oppositions. And when that hits you, then you feel, then it's possible to solve problems, you know, if you know mm-hmm. that we have to come off of oppositions in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And to refer back to that feeling of excitement that existed in the country and in the world after the war was over, mm-hmm. and we felt energized and free and liberated, yes, as we stepped onto Broadway. There were many, we could discuss anything. I remember going to a rally at Madison Square Garden, and there was Danny Kaye and various other people, and we were arguing what to do with the atomic bomb. Should we give it to the Russians, or should we keep it for ourselves? Mm-hmm. This was before the McCarthyite,
yes,
period, when people felt free to express themselves.
And mostly entertainers were at those rallies.
Yes, and there was a permissiveness in the air. I mean, you weren't afraid to open your mouth and say exactly what you felt about things. Mm-hmm. It was our world, and we'd fought a war, and we'd killed Hitler, and all that.
Yes.
And we were going to see, by God, that it didn't happen again.
Yeah. Yes, and actors, you know, you had a sense of acting about something. I mean, it wasn't just the job, you know.
Yeah. You were about something that was happening important in the world.
Yes.
It was only later, you know, that the powers that be came along and began to close down those avenues, and the theater and motion pictures never mm-hmm. recovered, you know, from the onslaughts, yes, of McCarthyism. Now we have timid stuff and stuff that really mm-hmm. Is anti-human. You know, we have violence and guns and explosions. Mm-hmm. And sex that has no meaning except its own, I don't know
when
how
you think
to
about
describe
it. Yes, we came from times when the arts were beginning to try to be responsible.
Exactly, you know? As a creative force mm-hmm. in the world. And the most exciting people we knew, even in the struggle, mm-hmm. were artists, you know, Lena Horne, Paul Robeson.
Yes. Avon Long, and most everybody we knew.
Yeah.
At some point, they and Harry Belafonte. Think of Harry, who's done so much in terms of coalescing support for people mm-hmm. that we believed in and came to admire. You know,
Canada Lee mm-hmm. and Billie Holiday singing a song, yes, called "Strange Fruit."
Yes.
You know, and a play on Broadway called "Strange Fruit." You mm-hmm. know, with Jane White in a play on Broadway called "On Whitman Avenue,"
yes,
you know, about race. And Hollywood jumped in with Pinky and No Way Out,
yes,
and various other expressions, and ropes and singing, you know, "The House I Live In," and all.
Yes.
It was an exciting.
And, you know, a friend who wrote that.
Earl Robinson.
Earl Robinson, yes. You know. All those people. That was a marvelous tapestry.
Oh, yeah, you know, the intellectual ferment of the times.
Mm-hmm. As if the shoot 'em ups, they were trying to balance up the shoot 'em ups, you know, because it was Cagney and Bogey and Humphrey and all, huh? You know, Bogey and Humphrey and Cagney and all the gun toting, you know, sexuals, talk about making of violence and shooting and killing and something that was bringing it into a new level of consciousness where that violence was fighting for people's allegiance and attention. Defining America, really, mm-hmm. that's what the arts,
and
that's what Hollywood did.
Even the arts were in a tailspin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the theater,
that's right,
began to embrace a new doctrine, the method, the Stanislavski,
mm-hmm.
where the whole function of theater was totally different from what it had been in the past. as a form of entertainment, where the carriage trade came and sat and tittered as it was titillated by some exercise and froth and whatever. Yeah. Now we had plays dedicated to the human condition, or plays that even suggested revolution, you know, and all of those things.
Filmmakers that were concerned.
Right.
And not worried primarily about box office and numbers and nobody, and they had the courage to exist, you know.
And then to all of that two eager young people, Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee. And we were
among
there.
Them, yes.
We were spear carriers and gophers, and you know, whatever the leadership needed, we would try and do to the best of our ability.
Yes, whatever the leadership needed. Yes,
you know, but
we were servants of the people in the movement.
The struggle had its own glamour. The struggle had its own organizational impact on us, and its own stimulus and stimulation.
Yes, I remember just meeting Malcolm, and my brother happened to be very closely associated. They lived close together with Malcolm, and he introduced us, had us go to the mosque and meet this young man. And I remember the feeling after we'd heard him, knowing that we wanted him to meet our friends in the theater. We wanted somehow to embrace him. We felt, I don't know what it is we were looking for.
Well, one of the things we were looking for was an answer to some specific questions. Now, obviously, Malcolm and the Black Muslims had made a tremendous impact, and they had a program, part of which was, you know, calling for five states to be given.
He had a program, that was
right?
It.
Yeah. And the regeneration of the black man, self-reliance, business activities, all of these programs were there. But we wanted questions as to what is your basic economic philosophy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how does it relate to the forces in the world, you know, forces of colonialism and what was happening in Africa and other places.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to find out to what degree did Malcolm really believe that white folks were blue-eyed devils, you know. And to that end, we invited him out to the house and got a few of our friends, Sydney
and John O'Killens and Grace and I don't know if Harry was there, but so many. I remember that day, and we took everybody's camera, remember, because we weren't taking pictures, and it was McCarthy. Everybody didn't want their pictures taken. You have to be careful who you get your pictures taken. So when Malcolm came with Wallace from the mosque, we had them take their camera in the bedroom, because everybody could feel comfortable to let their hair down. There would be no pictures.
That's why we did that. We never had a picture.
Mm-hmm, that's why we never had any pictures. Or the summit we called up at my friend Juanita Poitier's house. We called together Malcolm
Martin,
and Martin.
Dorothy
Height. And
Whitney
Young. And Lorraine Hansberry. And Philip. Yes. Mm-hmm. And they all came. Well, King didn't come because he was in jail.
Yeah,
and
we
didn't have any pictures that day either.
Yeah.
And we didn't have pictures, Ossie. It was astonishing.
Yeah, but the subject matter, Ruby.
Yeah, the subject.
I think was important.
Yes.
What we felt strongly was that Martin, who articulated the black middle class's position and the Southern position and the institutional church position, as against Malcolm, who articulated the urban dispossessed position, you know, that these two forces, you know, that they owed it to the black people to drop whatever differences they might have and come together, particularly since Malcolm, you know, had been put out of the black Muslims.
Yes.
And he was at that time very interested in trying to, you know, get on board the regular struggle.
Yeah, we touch on a little bit of this in the book, but we remember we didn't want to go into it because it begins to, you know, I didn't because I didn't feel qualified.
We didn't want the book to be a polemic historical document.
It was just things that we remembered in personal ways about these different people that came into our lives.
I can't hear the name Emmett Till without being driven to the depths of despair, 15-year-old youth killed, and the recent murder of Matthew Shepard. And your book does that. It takes me to almost the depths of despair in a very personal way. I felt almost a little voyeuristic reading the book. I was a bit embarrassed. I felt I had no right to be quite so close to two people, as much as I like them, that I didn't really know and might not want me that close, and also to the black psyche, in a way. And then from the depths of despair to moments of, my gosh, I didn't know Ozzy was in Liberia during the war. That's a heck of a place to be stationed. That's not exactly Fort Hood. And then to the something that's very rare about you two, because even today, there's only a handful of people that of your stature that we can count off as having the sense of social involvement that you do. I mean, the 1199 programs are not done by your peers. They're done by you folks. And as a matter of fact, there seem to be less people today who are available. The book was very much a treasure to see who you folks are, but it made me a little sad because there aren't enough of you folks.
Well, you know
somehow.
What, maybe one of the reasons why we decided to write, because we think life is something like a relay race. We really do have to take the what's at stake and bring it back to the next runner. And I think each generation, we owe it to each other, you know, in these. We owe each other an accounting so that we can build from one thing to the other and not feel that we started the whole process. I think we have to come into this feeling of a continuing thing. It is, even this whole business about sex and love and fidelity and marriage and all these things are all tied up. We're all tied up in our times and the rhythm of our times and the people there. They spell us, you know. And we in turn, the next generation is spelled on top of that spelling. That some of the new symbols are added. It's a terribly complicated time that young people have to live in now, but there's also a kind of a disruption in the emotional life of young people. I feel I think the times are so difficult today. Now maybe challenging, but we said, well, maybe if we could, there's something about the whole phenomenon of struggle and agitation and taking charge, putting both feet in your times, that bubbles up and spins in around you and makes you the kind of person that where your personal relationships come into more meaningful perspectives, and where you can reach and hold hands in different ways, just like education. We've got to change the pattern of education for our young people, because they are learning through sound bites and fast motions and what's happening with computers, and we have to find another way to teach, you know, 2 and 2 is 4. I mean, to say it out loud, it takes too long, or something like that. They're on a different wavelength, the young people, and I feel that their problems also, and the challenges of the times are on a different wavelength. And is there something that we can say about people moving together and understanding in common what we're about, so that we can move together to find some joy and peace and delight in life, you know?
Well, to get back to a point that you made about despair.
More of it, I mean.
And the fact that maybe there's a shortage of people with our commitment out there.
Oh, no, I don't think that for one minute. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is that this is something for which we should have been prepared. In terms of the human experience, it's easy enough oftentimes to fight the revolution and destroy the past and the evil and not to have paid enough attention to what you're going to replace it with. We achieved signal success in the revolution of the 60s and the 70s, but we were not prepared for the world that we ourselves created. And also, we were not prepared for the dazzle and flash of technology, which keeps cascading in on us at such a rapid rate that we are constantly off balance. And somebody has to say, look, no matter what a magnificent dance that is, all that flash and dazzle really is on the surface, and it's being used by the powers that be to blind you mm-hmm. as you know, as effectively as if it was a smokescreen. Mm-hmm. You have to, even in the flash and dazzle of technology, remember that there are certain basic verities to which you must pay attention, mm-hmm. or you know, you'll be blown away.
Yes, and love does count, and you can't turn it into a commodity.
So the fact that mm-hmm. two people, you know, like us, are still out there, and it would seem that the field is sort of barren, merely indicates that the time has not come, or the people themselves haven't been forced to step forward and begin to assert themselves. They feel now intimidated. But when the struggle gets acute, as it will, history has always said, you know, what Sterling Brown repeats, strong men and women keep coming on, and they keep coming. So a part of our faith is that there are those committed to struggle. We don't hear from them now. I don't know why, but they'll be there. And that the struggle continues. The battle is by no means over. And somebody will take up the gauntlet where we put it. I live in absolute faith. So I try not to practice despair, because that would put me in a position of making mm-hmm. judgments on the universe.
And
I'd be a little bit out of my britches. No, mm-hmm. I'm not talking about you. Okay. Our host was speaking of the possibility of despair.
I think about what Lorraine said. Go ahead.
You want to recite something?
Yeah, what Lorraine Hansberry said, talking about despair, you know.
Yeah.
And she said, why is it that you despairing ones think that only you have the truth? You know,
yeah.
And I think about that. But I don't think mm-hmm. we're despairing either. I mean, I think we're very...
Oh, no. If we were despairing, we'd be fools to be out on the hustings.
How about with this book? The drum, and the truth, I'm telling you.
No. We do it.
Tell me about it.
Not because mm-hmm. we're stubborn, but because we're people of faith. Mm-hmm. And we know that this isn't the first time that the human trip has gone through periods, you know, where we all got lost. And sometimes we never came back, we you know. Mm-hmm. But the capacity to get up out off your knees, out of the mud, and do it again.
Yeah.
Try it one more time. You never know, and it's never going to be given to any of us to see the final moment when struggle is no longer necessary. Suppose the Cold War had ended differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, suppose the left had won. You know, suppose it was now a socialist world in toto and capitalism was on the mat. Mm-hmm. Do you think struggle would be over? Do you think the work that needs to be done would be finished?
Mm-mm.
By no means. And there is no state of affairs to which we can aspire where there will no longer be struggle. The paradise we dream of and write of in our books, and the heaven where everything is in a state of stasis and we sit by the throne and, you know, live on milk and honey, that is good. We sometimes need an opiate. We sometimes need to be sedated. But the truth of existence is that struggle is at the core of existence. It's the in and out, the yin and yang, the yes and the no that makes the human experience work.
You know, also it occurs to me what we're trying to scream out or say a little bit or touch is that with the current crop of challenges that face in the world today, in terms of the economy, in terms of global manipulation of the workforce, in terms of greed and mindless accumulation and materialism, is that people are going to, it's going to hit us. You know, like so many people are being thrown out of work, this job, people are going to come to a point where they can't take it anymore. And which way do you turn? And how do you correct? But if you have some little blueprint for struggle, I think that's a little bit what we're trying to do. But this was a blueprint, to try to address some of the absolutely unprecedented challenges that are coming to young people today. Well, here is a little blueprint for struggle. You know, we take the baton, give it to the next person. So when you run your race in the next time out,
and it's literally a matter of life and death.
Yes, it is. It's survival.
The state of the world and the economy, mm-hmm. as we know it, will not sustain itself. We, you know, the big boom yeah. that sustained us is already over. You know, Russia and the ruble is totally collapsed,
mm-hmm.
and in Brazil.
Oh, yes.
You know, and all of those things, that there is still the possibility that this sort of casino culture, mm-hmm. you know, which generates tremendous profits, mm-hmm. may crash. Yes. I remember in 1929, I was a baby, but I remember that there was, mm-hmm. you know, a world depression. Now, if once again, you know, our way of doing things leads us into catastrophe, and huge masses of people are unemployed because robots and computers make their labor unnecessary, what will those people do? Mm-hmm. The choices will be that the masses will go toward what happened in Texas, will go toward fascism, will go toward mm-hmm. meanness and evil capacity of people to destroy each other. On the other hand, will we say, we can change this, we can control this, we can make this better? I'm betting on the good guys winning. But more than that, I'm putting my energy and whatever creative talent I have into saying, this is a way by which we can climb out of the pit of despair. We do not need to be fascist. We do not need to kill each other. Mm-hmm. There is a possibility that we can reorder our priorities and that the goods of the world can be more equitably distributed. We can create an economy where all of our people either work or earn an income, whether they work,
yes.
or not.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways by which we can resolve the problems that confront us. When the time comes and the shock of whatever cataclysm we might have produced hits us in the face, a lot of people, you know, will be stunned and they'll be running and, oh, what can we do to be saved? Well, somebody should be there. Well, I happen to have a prescription here that you might want to try.
Mm-hmm.
It's called love. It's called cooperation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's called justice. Mm-hmm. And we've tried it a little here and a little there.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe now the time has come to try it all over the world.
And that, as you say, that love will inform these prescriptions, love will inform the equations and the new economic arrangements that are before us.
Yeah. You know, the materialist fog in which we live now obscures the fact that there is a greater...
We're not talking about the book, I see.
Oh, we are. I'm sure there's a page where I waxed brilliant on this. I don't know where it was. But I will close my disquisition by saying this.
Mm-hmm.
I think we live in a time now which differs in the time in which you and I were married in one important aspect, in addition to others. Then we had a moral assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Now we don't have a moral assignment.
It's obscure,
that people...
Yes.
Can look at. Mm-hmm. I believe there's a moral assignment out
mm-hmm.
there. I believe that Martin Luther King was trying to leave us a moral assignment. I believe that the abolition of poverty, both material and spiritual, is the intellectual, spiritual, and cultural assignment of our times, and that we should be able to stand and summon, you know, the people to battle on the basis that this is the fight that will determine whether we have a future or not. So we become the voices that cry in the wilderness. Maybe it seems that people aren't even listening, but they are, you know. So you keep beating the drum, you keep spreading the message, and you keep laughing and having a good time doing it. I mean, I've had a good time. being married to you was one of the best things that ever happened to me. I don't know how you feel about it.
I know, because I worked hard at it.
But, you know, with all the descriptions I've seen of the two of you, the two things I didn't see about the book, and you, I like the idea of it being a blueprint. It is a blueprint for people to survive, because it is hard to live.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly hard for poor people to live, and it's hard for people of color to live, and it's hard for people who are ostracized and who the society would attempt to dehumanize in order to justify their own contempt of folks. So it's a blueprint. It's a blueprint for growth, and it's a wonderful blueprint for the amalgam of culture. Culture is a total way people live their lives. The other thing that wasn't said about the two of you which I knew before I read the book, you're remarkable intellectuals. You really are extraordinarily bright and articulate people. There's an intellectuality about the book, and you folks are, and perhaps that's why everything you do from the, you know, you were talking about Shalom Aleichem and from the raising of the sun and all these things, and they exude an intellectual sense, a way of analyzing and understanding the world that you live in. Mm-hmm. And you help other people understand the world they live in. And that's a remarkable contribution to give to people, aside from all the other contributions that you've made.
The people who have all the money, you know, have it, have access to everything, as against the people who do all the work. We have to see to it that knowledge is available and shared equally with everybody. And that is the intellectual responsibility. Not to be cute, not to show off, you know, but to share understanding, you know, among all of those who have a hunger and a need to know.
And that, in a sense, is love, you know, because when you really love somebody, you couldn't abide children starving. There's no way, and where I can make more money than a whole nation of people who are getting their food out of garbage pails, you know. Love must dictate that we share the world's resources. Economics, it must inform all these things we do.
You know, but now, there was a time when we couldn't share the world's resources with great facility, because there was always more mouths to feed than there was food to put in the mouths. Mm. And those in control of the world took advantage of that fact to establish themselves as the elite, the one who had all the power, the one who controlled the means of production and whatnot. But with the introduction of the Industrial Revolution and the science and technology into our lives, we literally now can afford, without effort, to feed every mouth in the world. The intellectual is supposed to understand that and make that truth available to those who still believe that the world of scarcity and its laws still pertain. So we need to tell the world, that was yesterday when there was never enough to eat to go around. Today what we suffer from is having too much. To tell that knowledge to the world, to the workers of the world, enable them to say, hey, we can change this. We can create a society and an economy and a culture where the tremendous capacity to produce goods will be used. We'll produce goods for use rather than goods for commodity and for sale.
Because we all came from that. We came from that time when people. That's what people were talking about. We weren't so far from when you don't forget. We came just in the Roosevelt years when all kinds of social problems projects were being developed to keep people from starving to death. You know, and work was, there was work. And now we come to another place where I'm waiting for the other shoe to fall. Whenever I read of another 10,000, 100,000 people being laid off by this corporation so that the CEOs can make more money and they can have a bigger bonus and they don't can cut costs and get rid of the people, it worries me. We're calling down another kind of poverty on ourselves, this poverty of irrational accumulation. You know, and turning us all into another kind of slavery. You know, it's coming.
And look at the theater as a university or
beautiful
as a teaching institute, as far as Ruby and Asi are concerned. One play in particular exemplifies the change in us, the growth in us that was offered by the theater itself. A play called The World of Sholem Aleichem. Mm. And it featured Howard De Silva as one of the actors, Maurice Karnofsky is one of the actors, Arnold Pearl is the writer, Phoebe Brand, and several others. Our association with them introduced us to their concept of theater, which was totally different from what we had thought. Mm-hmm. The theater as an expression of the people's culture, a theater as an exemplar of working people with their crafts and their arts mm-hmm. being ennobled and being made important, came into our lives. Mm-hmm. And we never backed away from that. You know, entertainment, yes, but theater as an intensifier of the struggle itself, mm-hmm. you know, was made possible to us because these people had that point of view and they shared it
yes,
with us.
Yes, you know, but still, I know, I don't know if we said this in the book, but I feel a terrible fury with Hollywood, with the top echelon of entertainment. Because I think about Hollywood, there's a slogan comes to my head, the USA made in Hollywood, you know. I think of that. The marvelous things we've reckoned with, but the horror of the images that by which we're now governed, and what a terrible responsibility those who feed our children's stuff into our children's heads. What some of those images have done is like drinking poison, putting poison into your body without balancing it with something else. There's a fury I feel with this power that it hasn't done nearly enough, and it's done too little of trying to be about what the divine intention. You know, and blaming those who are victimized. One example, you know, we're kids with guns today. You know, it's nothing. It's nothing. It's parents, and we're beaten up on parents. When I think of the terrible guilt of the arts and complicity in the degradation of our children and our society, there's a fury that I'm just praying to God to help me to understand, and what can we do while we're here to help make it better for all of the, because we've seen how it could be better. So anyway, with that, because it's cumulative. Oh, this made money, you know. So why not do it 10 times more? Don't do films that threaten to be uplifting or something like that. I'm trying to reckon and deal with all that, with all the people I love in the arts and in the business aspect of it. There's still this I don't understand, because what we think, what we watch, and what we see, what goes into our minds as much as what we are, what we put into our bodies.
I wanted to ask you, there was an article in the Times last weekend, actually, about reassessing the McCarthy period. Yes. And I noticed that you sort of talked about World War II and the hope yes. of that period, and then stopped at the McCarthy period. Mm-hmm. What happened during the McCarthy period as far as you were concerned, mm-hmm. to your work, to your friends?
Mm-hmm. Well, there were certain impulses and things that were happening in the communities of which I'm a member, the black community is one, the labor community is another, mm-hmm. and the theatrical community, of which I thought we were proud. You know, we had helped to establish the United Nations, and we were looking forward to the end of colonialism, and we were looking forward to the realization of the kind of world that Roosevelt had promised us in 1944, where everybody would have a job and all of that stuff. And when those things were not forthcoming, you know, we began to raise questions and to make nuisances of ourselves. When Churchill came and went to Fulton, Missouri, I think it was, and announced the Iron Curtain, and there was, instead of the camaraderie that we had felt between the American GIs and the Russian soldiers, you know, that ended World War II, all of a sudden you had a Cold War. But once again, we were confronting each other, and this time confronting each other with one of us having a bomb that could destroy civilization. We felt that our voices were beginning to be challenged, our right to speak were beginning to be challenged, and little by little we were demonized, and little by little we were made ineffective, and all of our creative energies had to be spent, you know, just defending ourselves or defending our rights. to speak. We never really recovered from that as an artistic community, and that's one of the reasons why Hollywood and Broadway slipped imperceptibly toward the exposition of stuff that had no intellectual content whatsoever, because that way McCarthy certainly wouldn't bother you. But when we saw the people we loved shut down, a man like Robeson, for example, we closed off the avenues for earning a living in America, and then the State Department took his passport so he couldn't earn a living overseas. But those of us in the black community, you know, we saw the connection. We knew what was going on, and we knew what that signaled and what that meant. And we spent, about 8 years just trying to get Paul his passport back.
So many.
And
people died, killed themselves.
And we saw people like Lumumba killed, and people like Arbenz in Guatemala destroyed, and people like Mossadegh in Iran, you know, being put down.
A lot of theater people, John Henry Falk in Canada.
All of these great forces that were determining the coloration of the world experience were under attack and under assault. And those of us who tried to show support, either to them or to their ideals, we were also under attack and under assault.
Well, also, you know, the unique thing about that, and I know we've been at this, is the fact that it affected us in a strange way. Because, although I understand we were on some lists, and I was in Ed, and I made a speech in favor of not killing the Rosenbergs, you know, because for so many reasons, because very many of our supporters in the early civil rights movements were white, were Jews, were people who were against lynching and the brutality and the poll tax and all that. All these struggles was a coalition going on there that was admirable. So when I was asked to speak for the Rosenbergs, we couldn't think about hesitating to say, oh no, these people must not be executed and so forth. It was a ridiculous thing. But to hear people say, oh, you're going to, they'll put you out of Hollywood. You won't be able to earn any. You won't be able to get a job. Well, Ossie and I, we shouldn't say this, but we went sort of like howl because we never felt that even remotely touched us. We didn't belong to those. We didn't belong to that crowd where it could even touch us. And we would say, I never will forget, well, how can you see a little bit of red and so much black, you know? It was a strange time for us, but we felt a confidence. We worked more. We met people that we never would have met. Those people have been forced out of Hollywood. It was a marvelously important time for us. So we were affected.
There was also another way in our response that set us aside.
Yeah.
We as black people, you know, expected to be kicked. We expected to be lynched. Mm-hmm. We didn't welcome it, but that was what was happening to black folks, you know. If we didn't get the job, we knew why, you know, it wasn't unusual. So along come this bright, brilliant group of people who for one moment on top of the world, and now they too are getting kicked and they too are getting upset. And to them, it's their world's crumbling. But to us, it wasn't, because we never had that world. So Ruby and I and some others, we went through the McCarthyite period, you know, and we suffered it, but we also laughed at it. Because we said to our friends, oh, you didn't know this was happening. You should have been black for a while, and you would have been prepared, you know. So there was a kind of humorous overtone to all our response. And even to this day, the McCarthy, the punishment they gave us, you know, was limited in our own minds because we never took it quite as seriously, as we should have.
You were on this list and you were on this book, and it's the most incredible thing, you know. But there were blacks who were deeply affected, who lost, you know, work. I think about Canada. I think about many people who were making lots of money and that sort of thing. But we had found a way to make a living, independent of Hollywood and Broadway and stuff. So we...
Let's not pontificate any further. Okay. Talk to me about the book. What do you
think? Ossie, Isn't It the Truth?
Yes. Marvelous. Ossie and Ruby in this life together.
I hope you
so yummy. Oh, I'm going to run out and buy a copy right now. You know, find out what it's all about.
Please.
And so what do you think about the book? Yes, what's your response?
A great relief that we finished it. And that it's finally being sold.
But you
sold.
Think that all that effort was worthwhile?
Yes, I do.
All that blood on the
just
floor.
Just to hear the kids say, "Mom, why didn't you tell us so and so and so?" And the deep pain that I didn't ask my children, that my parents, to tell me. I bought my mother a tape recorder, but I didn't teach her how to really use it. So that source of deep pain to me that I didn't get from my parents, and I'm hoping that this will teach them to give to their children, because we need that sense of continuity. We need a flow from each other, you know, so that we don't feel that we just start from scratch.
Well,
hop out the womb and start from scratch.
What about those areas where we disagree on what we saw?
But that's okay.
There were things I described vividly.
Yes.
And you look at them and say, it wasn't that way at all.
That's right.
How do we resolve that?
Well, I'm hoping that they'll understand that there's such a difference between the male mind and the female mind. And the female needs a great deal of patience. And also to, you know, and when she... You learn how to have to suffer and agitate creatively.
There was never in our lives, as I remember, a major point of difference on a major issue. What we might have differed on, as we remembered, was some detail that you saw that I'd forgotten, or some detail that I saw that you forgot, or some incidents that I remembered that you don't, that you've totally put out of your mind, I think.
And
or vice versa.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
And also he's a very nonviolent person and so
which means I'm a coward, huh?
No, that's not easy.
I would accept
not a,
that.
But it's a good thing that I'm not very large in stature, because I probably would have annihilated him by now. And he'd be speaking to me from a jail cell or something. because I'm far from, I had to teach myself, you know, it's like, you know, how short people can get to be such bullies.
No, but women have to express themselves. And you have some wonderful, wonderful passages about women. I love the little interchange there when you decided to take an acting class after the arrival of the baby.
Yes.
And Ozzy suddenly says, "But of course, if that's all you had wanted to begin with, oh, sure," as though you hadn't had to convince him of that.
Yes, exactly. But one thing.
Oh, is that exactly, or am I just creating dissent here?
But there was one lucky thing that I encountered, and that is the fact that he was a very, he's a good pupil. He was sensitive, and I really could alert him to things, and he was. Some things that he did, he really didn't know any better. He was the first grandchild. He was the first nephew. He was one of the first boy in his family. He was adored. And he has a great disposition, a sense of humor. So he really didn't have, he doesn't come through, you know, these difficult, rough, emotional things. So, I don't know. What was I saying all that about?
I wonder.
But what I mean to say is that so he was why he was eager for and this was pre female feminism, you know what I'm saying? And so we the feminist movement, so the things that rattled me, I was just wrestling with stuff that I wasn't quite sure of. So we had to go through that together rather than the movement in the atmosphere hadn't struck yet.
Let me ask you one final question,
okay,
which would close this whole session out.
All right.
If the whole thing was presented to us again, and I dashed into your life and proposed that on a Thursday you and I take the train to New Jersey and get married, would you do it again?
Ossie, don't ask me those kinds of questions. Suppose I said...
You're not under oath, you know. You always lie. You can tell me. Make me feel good. Say
oh,
yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Say yes, Ruby. Don't hurt me.
I'll say yes.
Okay.
I'll say more than yes. There's some things that happen out beyond your... you know, beyond. And I think I was lucky in that respect. I think we really did come together from someplace else to finish something.
Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee, you are entirely too gracious. Maybe we can just round it out. What's the next project? As you approach your 50th wedding anniversary.
Yes. We're going to have a big blowout, you know.
Speak to us about it.
We're going to at the Grand Hyatt on 42nd Street in New York on December the 15th. Our anniversary is on the 9th. We're having this party on the 15th. It's going to benefit 12 theaters based in New York, the kind where both of us met in theaters. Me and from the American Negro Theater, Ossie from the Rose McClendon Players, and we're going to benefit these places, and we hope people will come. And that's what we're working on right now. And we have, of course, we both have a couple of movies coming out, things like that.
Well, tell us a little bit about the movies that are coming up. Get some advance publicity over here.
Oh, well, I just finished one last week. One of them is called...
The Passing Glory.
It's about basketball. And then we've been doing some Promised Lands together that are coming out. One tonight, as a matter of fact. Oh, Ossie, we won't be seeing it.
And, how lucky we are.
Oh, Ossie.
All right, okay.
And we have a couple of films... in the wings that we're about to embark on, but I don't want to talk about those.
Ruby, you know, last year did a stint at Hunter, you know, called My One Good Nerve, based on her works, which was very well received.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we get this thing put to bed, we're going to go back in motion, probably go to Los Angeles and go across the country. I myself am finishing a play I started about 37 years ago for Ruby, and hopefully I'll present it to her before the year's out.
And that it won't wind up that he's going to be the star of it.
Not this time. You got more. Okay.
Well, dear friends, thank you, because one thing about the book and everything else you've done, we can't afford to ever lose you folks, and... you've given us a lot, and there's a lot to preserve, and so everybody's got to go out and read it and keep something that's quite sacred, including the small drops of blood, sweat, and toil that we'll put into the effort.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
And that's all for this edition of Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report.
Building Bridges was produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
To contact Building Bridges, you can email us at mer@legal-aid.org.